molecular interactions. So that's clearly a huge effort that's going to take decades to get to. And then the final goal of developing quantitative models of cells, I think actually from a computational standpoint, this may not be so difficult. I think the computational methods are not actually all that complicated, but the real limitation to being able to do this is, based on the approaches we have now, is the lack of good experimental methods that allow us to quantitate accurately lots of different molecules in the cell at the same time. And until we have better experimental methods that allow us to do that, I think it's difficult to think about how we're really going to be able to model these cells and make predictions as to what the effects of perturbing part of the system would be. So anyway, I'm just going to talk about gene prediction with the idea that it's a route to identifying the protein parts list. And Chris actually listed a number of different approaches to finding genes in his talk. I just really wanted to make the point that is there a laser pointer around?
Well,
that's fine. Okay. High-tech laser pointer. Okay. So I just wanted to make the point that really all the methods we have now, both experimental and computational, have significant limitations in terms of their power to identify all genes. So random cDNA or even protein sequencing has been used as a method to identify genes. But it's kind of sobering to think that in C. elegans, where there are well over 100,000 ESTs or partial cDNA sequences have been identified, that these detect less than half the genes that we think are there. The fraction might be higher, might well be higher in humans because there's been a lot more EST sequencing there. But even there, it's probably not higher than about 80% or so.
When you say random cDNA, that's just grinding up cells and determining what messenger RNAs are around?
Right, right. And there are refinements to that method that try to get rid of the most abundant messages so that you enrich for the rare ones. But even so, using all those techniques, you miss a lot of genes, presumably because they're only expressed at very low levels in particular cell type that you might just miss. C. elegans is actually a favorable case because we're pretty confident we surveyed all tissues and developmental stages. You grow them in the lab and they have a short life cycle. But for humans, we have not sampled large numbers of tissues and developmental stages, so it would be even harder to get to complete representation of all genes in the human case, I think. Another approach that's been a classical genetic approach is to try to induce mutations in organisms and look to see what effect they have. And when you knock out a gene or disrupt a gene in some way, you get a phenotype if you're lucky. But it's been observed for a number of organisms now that 75% or so of the time, you can knock out a gene and you don't see any effect at all. So, and that's presumably partly because of redundancy in cellular pathways, that the cell has more than one way to carry out any particular operation it needs to do, but also because it may be that many genes have a very sort of subtle modulating effect, and knocking it out, you just can't see the difference. You would see the difference over long periods of evolutionary time, but you can't detect it in the lab. So that's not a terribly sensitive approach. the microarray-based approaches that Chris mentioned, particularly this recent work of Rosetta, seem really promising. But even those, that's an approach where you you predict genes in the genome, or even just make oligonucleotides for the entire DNA sequence, and then take cDNA from different tissues to see what lights up, and that gives you an indication of whether a particular segment is transcribed or not. But there are issues with those as well. We don't really have a good idea how many genes, what proportion of genes we'll be able to detect. But it's clear that rarely expressed genes are still going to be missed. Another issue is that it's actually not a very sensitive way of finding the boundaries of exons. That might not be too serious, but the hybridization data doesn't really tell you. It's not precise enough to tell you exactly where the splice sites are, for example. And another issue is that it's probably true that there's a lot of noise in transcription data, or in transcription, that the cell has transcriptional machinery that ideally would recognize only genes and transcribe those, but it also almost certainly transcribes other regions that are not genes as well, and we don't really have a good idea of how much noise there is of that type. I get a little nervous about reports of genes detected via testis, because testis is an example of a tissue where there seems to be a lot of, well, some people think that there's a lot of transcription that actually is not playing a functional role, that the transcriptional machinery is more active than in other tissues. So, and we've actually seen examples of transcripts from testis libraries that appears to be clearly not functional. It's starting in the middle of a gene and is not not encoding any functional part of the protein that's known to be encoded by that locus. So,
is the gene bank contaminated significantly with misspecification and fragments?
Well, so it is something to worry about. So the EST data certainly has lots of issues. The ESTs are partial cDNA sequences where people have made cDNA libraries and then just gotten one read or sometimes two reads from each clone. And there's a lot of noise in that because in making a cDNA library is inherently error prone. You get genomic DNA contaminants, you get unspliced or partially spliced versions of genes. The clones you make sometimes rearrange. The reverse transcriptase, which is used to make the clones in the first place, or the DNA that's inserted into the clones, is error prone, both at the level of individual nucleotides and at the level of putting in correct contiguous sequence. It has a tendency to create clones in which the sequence is actually rearranged. There's that kind of noise in any cDNA library, and people, scientists who work on individual genes and study those genes and have sequenced them in a variety of different organisms, they pay a lot of attention to whether their cDNA clone that they sequence, whether that's correct or not. They make a big effort to make sure it's full length and that they get a lot of copies of clones from the same gene. And so those tend to be fairly reliable. But even so, people still make mistakes. And well, not detailed peer review of the sequence itself, but you do. Papers are peer reviewed, and so in theory, you know, the referee, if he or she is doing his job, which is not always the case, can make some assessment as to how good the data is likely to be, but you don't catch all problems anyway. And there are examples of cDNA clones, cDNA sequences that include vector sequence in them. There have been a couple of examples I can think of. Yeah, it's actually the bacterial sequence in the plasmid that you clone. There's a lot of variability, and it's definitely an issue that you have to deal with in any kind of sequence analysis. And I don't actually know if there are good numbers for eukaryotes. What I would sort of suspect is that there's less noise in bacteria because they're more highly evolved than we are, basically. Bacteria and other rapidly reproducing organisms have been under actually much greater selective pressure to optimize their entire machinery than we have. They've undergone more, they're more highly evolved in the sense that they've undergone more generations since the last common ancestor. Mm-hmm. That's true in eukaryotes as well, that's true. I mean, the transcription machinery is more complicated in eukaryotes, but I don't know. Do you happen to know, Gary, anything about studies of sort of bulk RNA from bacteria?
Not really. It's pretty complicated. I mean, people think there's some noise somewhere in the system, but probably the messages would have short half-life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably difficult to detect.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any quantitative, I haven't seen any good quantitative estimate of how much RNA transcription there is.
Yeah, it's bound to be there. I would say in any system, but I would think there's relatively less in bacteria. And as far as the computational methods, Chris also listed these. They all have limitations. We know that a substantial fraction of genes are relatively rapidly evolving in the sense that you don't find any detectable similarity to genes in from organisms in different phyla. And there's the issue even for genes, even if you look at relatively close relatives, so for example, mice versus human, that's certainly going to be a powerful way to identify genes by finding the regions that are more highly conserved, but regulatory regions are also conserved. There are some big regulatory regions, there are regions that it may well be hard to sort out whether you have a gene or not. And also, some genes are rapidly enough evolving that even with a relatively close relative, you may not see similarity that is substantially above background. Ideally, we'd like to be able to understand transcription, splicing, and translation well enough that we could take a DNA sequence and, knowing how the machinery works, knowing what it's going to recognize as a promoter and so forth, we could predict what's going to be, what the transcripts are and how they're going to be spliced. But that's really a long ways off, because there are significant components of the machinery that have not been identified yet, and we don't, even for the components that have been identified, we don't know in enough detail their molecular specificity that we could make these predictions. So, and then finally, the ab initio prediction methods, which I don't really like that term, because this kind of prediction, all these methods require input data. None of them are from first principles. And if we could do this, I think that it would be really ab initio prediction. But anyway, but prediction based on probabilistic modeling of gene structure. And here, I'm actually optimistic that with lower organ, well, it's not politically correct to say lower organisms, in fact, because they're all organisms have been evolving for the same amount of time. But so I get into trouble with evolutionary biologists when I say that. But simpler organisms, less complex organisms, I think. These probabilistic models that really don't take into account homology information and so forth, that these may be almost powerful enough to get us very close to fully accurate prediction. So I'm actually going to be talking about ab initio prediction that we've been doing in C. elegans and what ideas we're using there. But certainly with current analyses, these methods are all dependent on the input data that you have. And there are a number of reasons to think, and I'll mention some of these, that the genes that have been identified so far are not really representative of the genome as a whole. The genes that have been identified so far are ones that biologists have focused on for one reason or another, and they or have identified through particular routes like mutation screens, and those are not necessarily going to be representative. So anyway, I think basically all of these methods are, none of these methods is perfect. They're actually all, what's disturbing is they're all biased in more or less the same way against detecting rarely expressed, more rapidly evolving genes. And so they're worst on the their performance is worst on the same set of genes. And to compensate for that, to the best we can, I think all the methods do need to be used. There still may be genes that really are going to be extremely difficult to detect by any method. But we'll need to hope that each, you know, combining data of various sorts gives you a few percent improvement each time you throw in data of a different type. So,
if they're rarely expressed and they're rapidly evolving these non rare
right.
Why do you care about them that much?
Because they're there. Okay. So presumably, so these are genes. They're doing something, or they wouldn't be there. But they may provide very subtle selective advantages, and so it's they may be it may be that they're going to be very hard to study in the lab. That you won't see be able with a laboratory assay to really detect their importance. But their effect on the organism. But since they are there, they have been selected for in evolution, so they do play some biological role.
Are there examples where it looks like there's selection to increase your diversity or accelerate?
Yes, that's true. So there are examples where the rapid things like the interferon genes, for example, are very rapidly evolving, and so in some cases the rate of evolution actually reflects the fact that these are responses to changing features of the environment. Okay. So I want to talk about some work we've done in ab initio gene prediction in C. elegans. And this is just a picture that I stole off the web. And it's mainly to make the point that this is a very well-studied organism biologically. It's actually a very good organism to try out sequence analysis methods on, because a lot is known about it. It's actually translucent, so you can study it under the light microscope and detect all the different cells. And back in the late 70s and early 80s, the complete pattern of cell divisions that give rise to the adult was worked out. The adults have the same number of cells.
What's the meaning of the number 969?
Yeah.
Plus or minus zero.
I mean, this is, so it's, C. elegans has two different sexes, hermaphrodites and males. And 959 is the number of cells that hermaphrodites have. The hermaphrodites are actually the predominant sex. They can fertilize themselves, or they can fertilize other other worms. No, that's not true. That wouldn't be true. I mean, I'm sure you can kill a few cells and it still survives. But the adults have, barring some kind of injury, they have the same number of cells. And there's an invariant pattern. In this respect, they're different from humans or other vertebrates, for example, where there is not an invariant pattern of cell divisions that gives rise to adults. There's variability in that process.
If you break off a few cells, will it reactivate embryology?
No, I don't think it would do that. Although it presumably depends on the cells. This is not counting germ cells, so sperm and eggs, which they are churning out. It's the final number of living cells. As the cell divisions take place, some cells die. They actually have to die, or you don't get a viable adult. But you wind up with 959 living cells, and they're that lineage is very well understood. And it's partly because they are the animals are translucent, so you can study them under the microscope. The genome sequence is almost completely done, but there are still a few gaps. And it was mainly done at Washington University in St. Louis and the Sanger Center in England.
And these things have very little non-coding DNA?
It's about 25% coding DNA. So there's a fair amount of non-coding stuff as well, and it's and some fraction of that is involved in regulation, but it may be another 10% or so of the DNA is thought to be involved in regulation. Although that's not a hard estimate by any means. So I will skip. Chris talked about gene structure, alternative splicing. I wanted to make the point in terms of genome organization that you do have you have genes on both strands, and you can have overlapping genes. This is the most common kind of example of overlapping gene, where you have one gene embedded entirely in a single intron of another gene. Generally, when that happens, the gene is on the opposite strand. There are a few cases where you have an embedded gene on the same strand, but those are quite rare. There are also a few cases in C. elegans where you actually have several interleaved exons. So you might have cases where there's one exon in of the opposite strand gene on this intron, and another here, but those are pretty rare, and it's actually, if you think about it, it's hard to imagine how those would have evolved, but a small number of them do exist.
But the exons don't overlap?
I don't think in C. elegans. I don't think there are any known examples where the coding sequences actually overlap, but that could happen in theory. There are overlapping transcripts even overlapping process transcripts, but I think in all those cases it's untranslated region in one transcript that. I'm not sure there's a good estimate, but I think judging from our predictions, and if you take our prediction seriously, it looks like about 1 to 2% of introns have an embedded gene like this. That could be too high or too low if we have false positives or false negatives. But I think that it's about right. I think it's about in that range. Right. Right. So there definitely, Mark's point is there definitely are examples in bacteria where the actual coding regions of the genes overlap. And I don't know of any such example in C. elegans or any eukaryote for that matter, although there's an exception to every rule in biology, so I'm sure there must exist one somewhere. C. elegans has a couple of complications that cause some problems for gene prediction. One of these is that it has a phenomenon called transplicing, specifically transplice leaders, in which what happens basically is if you look at most messages, I believe the most recent estimate is maybe 50% of messages have these transplice leaders. What you find is that the first 22 or 23 bases are not found in the genomic region where the rest of the message is transcribed from. These are actually transcribed from some other region in the genome and then spliced onto the during RNA processing. They're spliced onto the process message from the gene itself. So the main issue that creates for us in gene prediction is that the initial exon looks like an internal exon. The first exon of the gene looks like an internal exon because it starts with a 3' splice site, namely the site that gets spliced onto the transplice leader. So this increases the error, a particular type of error in the predictions, namely fusing two genes together that are in fact are distinct. The other phenomenon that's found is cistrons, or cases where two genes are transcribed together as part of the, so you have a single initial RNA transcript that covers both genes. Then what happens is both that's split up into two separate mRNAs in the process of splicing and polyadenylation. So you wind up eventually with a single messenger RNA per protein. It's which is different from bacteria, where you can have a single messenger RNA that includes the coding sequences for several proteins. But again, because the genes in a cistron tend to be very close to each other, you may frequently have only 100 base pairs or so separating them. And since in these cistronic cases, actually, you always have transplicing, so the first exon of the second gene always starts with a something that looks like an internal exon. These are sort of hot spots for fusion errors in the gene predictions.
Is it fair to say that gene finding in prokaryotes is essentially a solved problem?
Mark should answer that. Do you consider it a solved problem? So it's not. It's not solved.
Thank you. Okay.
I'm not sure I can answer all those questions. There's maybe five or six different transplice leaders. There are two predominant forms, one of which is used specifically in this situation where you have a cistron of two genes, and that leader is used to splice onto the second gene to separate it. And then there's another leader that's for the majority of individual genes that are single genes that are transcribed is winds up as a leader for those genes. I'm not sure if it's really understood what they're doing. They presumably play some role in translational efficiency, help proteins, the ribosomes recognize the message and initiate translation more efficiently. But beyond that, I don't know. It's possible they could also play some role in transport of the messages out of the nucleus. And,
is there any particular signal that you can identify which transplice genes are associated with which mRNA?
Well, yeah, the sequence tells you. I mean, it's 22 or 23 bases, and at the beginning, and it's always this, or it always tells you with what the leader is.
How do you know the transcribing leader?
Yeah, that's the way they were found. Was the first, I think, one of the first full-length messenger RNAs that was sequenced. The genomic region from where the gene was located was also sequenced, and there was no trace. Those 22 bases were missing, and then eventually it was determined. It was noticed that a number of messages had the same sequence, there is a gene in the genome that where those 22 bases are part of the sequence, and that's it was discovered that the transcription is taken. Well, so when we're predicting genes, all we're trying to do is predict the coding regions, and the transplice leader does not extend into the coding region of the gene. So the first ATG translation start site would be somewhere here, typically, or might be in an internal the next exon downstream. So we actually do try to predict these sites. To avoid making the fusion errors, our probabilistic model does allow for these transplice leader sites, I call them, which are just splice sites that are used in the transplicing, and we do. We use those in the prediction, although since we're just interested in the coding sequence, they don't actually figure into the actual predicted sequence that we output.
Is there any evidence that your prediction sometimes makes the mistake of using that fusion?
Right.
But that might happen in reality too. It's perfectly good if on chapter site, if there's a fusion with the side upstream.
I'm sure it has been observed, but I don't know of any examples offhand. I mean, there are enough aberrant cases, and it's probably controversial whether the fact that it's been observed really means that there's some functional importance to it.
Depends on where the upstream.
Right. I mean, the point is, I mean, you've got alternative splicing going on anyway, so why not have, there must be cases where instead of this being spliced to a transplice leader, it might be spliced, say, to this exon up there, and so you get a single fused coding region.
And these transplice leaders, are highly variable to the cells, or they're not
They are, the sequences are actually similar to each other, and they're, you know, like I said, there are five or six different ones, and they do have similarities.
And the function is to help it get out of the
nucleus? That could be, or it could be to promote efficient translation recognition by the ribosomes. But these are, it's kind of interesting. As far as I know, the only other eukaryotes that, besides C. elegans, that have this are also nematodes. I don't. It's not been observed to take place with any human genes or other organisms that I know about. Although I could have missed a report of that. So what we want to do is. We want to push the ab initio methods as far as we can to, although I agree with Chris's view that the most accurate gene prediction is going to require bringing in other types of information. We are curious to see how far you can push the ab initio methods how accurate you can make the predictions just using those alone. And that requires, I think, making the models more and more complex to deal with the biological complexities. So our initial goal is to try to predict genes as sequences of coding exons. We don't try to identify untranslated regions or promoters. We just want to get the coding sequence. And alternative splicing is obviously a complication which we don't try to deal with. We initially just want to get at least to get one spliced form correct per gene. That's the initial goal. Although ultimately, since we want the entire list of proteins, we will need to deal with alternative splicing. So anyway, just to sort of set up the probabilistic framework. You all can tell me how much detail you want to see on this. But the basic idea, I think it goes back to Gary, the idea of trying to have a full probabilistic model for the entire sequence. Certainly probabilistic ideas in gene prediction are much older than that. Mark used Markov models back in the 80s and various other people have used probabilistic models for site prediction, but I think it's right that isn't your paper really the first one where you proposed as a formal goal trying to model the entire sequence?
I think so. I remember somebody else describing the first previous.
Uh-huh. So anyway. That's clearly had a big influence on the field. The subsequent work on hidden Markov models are one approach to try to implement full probabilistic models. So we use the main differences in our approach are really in detail. We don't use hidden Markov models because partly because I think although I like them and they're very mathematically elegant, I think. You need to get as close to the biological situation, the underlying biology, as possible. And I think at some point, although you can do almost anything using HMMs, if you make the state space complicated enough, after a while it stops being natural and it's not very flexible. So we don't use them explicitly, although I think you probably could convert everything that we do into an HMM framework. So the basic idea is that we want to find a parse of the genome in Gary's sense, which is an assignment of sites and other biological features, coding sequence, to the genome sequence, to specific locations. There'll be a probability for any a priori parse, there'll be a probability associated to that. And then you will also have a conditional probability given the parse of the observed sequence. So the problem, basically, that we're trying to solve, we want to find the maximum likelihood parse in the sense that this joint probability of the sequence and the parse is maximized. And the natural way to represent that is the a priori probability of the parse times the conditional probability of the sequence given the parse. And once you have a parse, that gives you your gene predictions for the region that you've produced the parse for. So parse is defined, there's several ways you can think of it. It's as a list of sites at the boundaries of the exons, or you can think of it as a set of the coding exons themselves. There are obvious constraints on adjacent sites, that if you have a 5' splice site, then the next site downstream of that, at least on the same strand, has to be a 3' splice site, and so forth. So the parses we allow, Chris did in his model, we simultaneously predict genes on both strands, but we also, beyond that, we allow one gene to be embedded in another. So we do want to allow the case where one gene is embedded entirely in the intron of a gene on the opposite strand. And actually, the method we use could allow more complex interleaving of genes, but that's we haven't really pushed that because that's rare, and would probably just create additional noise in the predictions. So that's just a definition of coding exons, which is sort of the natural unit that we work with, it's defined by the sites, their types, and the reading frame across the exon, and the gene, I think, has the obvious interpretation is just it's going to be a set of adjacent exons. Remember, we're just talking about coding exons, but it's a set of adjacent coding exons on the same strand, which satisfies the appropriate constraints on the sites. And we do allow, as I said, we allow one gene to be completely embedded in an intron of another on the opposite strand. In principle, if we think of a parse not as a list of exons, but as a list of sites, then with each site having a strand, it's either top or bottom, a location, and a type, then the most general probability distribution you could define on sequences of sites would be the obvious one in terms of conditional probabilities, where you allow the probability of the next site in your sequence of sites to depend on all the previous sites that have occurred. That's too general for us. Basically use something it's like first order Markov condition, but we need to allow, because we're predicting on both strands and allowing embedded genes, we need to have the probability depend on the previous site on both strands. So it really depends, each site probability, conditional probability of each site depends on potentially two previous sites.
Sorry, T of 3, is the subscript T of 3
tells you
on another strand?
I should have put that in. T of 3, what this means, Right, yeah, T of I. So S of T sub T of I would be the last site prior to S sub I minus 1 on the strand opposite to S sub I minus 1. So it's just kind of a klebsy notation, just to indicate that I'm looking at the two previous sites, the most recent site on the same strand and the most recent site on the opposite strand. Yeah, I'm fixing an order, and so right, I'm processing both strands at the same time, but going in a single order, so it'll be reverse order for genes on the opposite strand. Yeah, I mean, I just said. This would be the most general possible way of defining a probability distribution on lists of sites would be in terms of conditional probabilities. I mean, this is, I think you see this formula in a first year probability course. But it's just the obvious fact that. Sorry? That's right, yeah.
So this sequence is actually defined, not DNA sequence itself.
Right. It's a, the parse is just the list of sites.
Yes.
So these are not nucleotides, these are sites. And each site has a location, a type, and a strand designation.
The reason you want to study strands is just because
you want to do your predictions for both strands at the same time, because if you do them independently, you tend to make spurious predictions. Sometimes they're called shadow predictions. It actually turns out with a number of organisms that if you have the coding sequence, say you have an exon for a gene, that there's actually, there's certain probability models that describe the coding sequence, but it turns out that on the complementary strand, for an appropriate choice of reading frame, one of the three reading frames, you actually get what looks like coding sequence according to your original model. So when you predict each strand separately, you tend to have the same genes showing a gene that's on the top strand showing up in sort of a bastardized form on the bottom strand with some of the exons there and so forth. And it's really to avoid that. I think older methods. Older approaches would predict for each gene, each strand separately, but then you'd have to go through the predictions and discard ones that didn't look real and looked like they were just due to being the complements of true of the correct prediction. Okay, so in any case, so we're basically saying the probability that SN, the nth site has a certain type, location, and strand depends. We're assuming that it depends only on the type, location, and strand of the preceding sites. And these are we also you can think to make it a little more intuitive. There are really three types of cases, at least for sites on the same strand. That the two sites you're looking at can flank an exon, they can flank an intron, or they can flank an intron, or they can flank an intergenic region, as it is done here. So the basically the conditional probabilities need to reflect those types of situations. And so the type probabilities, so the conditional probability of a site given the preceding sites on both strands, basically incorporate type probabilities, the type of a site given the preceding site. And these really reflect the constraints on what genes look like, but also allow you to give specific probabilities for starting new genes and ending a gene and so forth. And these implicitly take into account average numbers of exons in genes. They take into account the dependence of the location of the site, takes into account exon size distribution, intron size distribution, intergene size distributions, and also their intergene type probabilities that take into account whether or not the next gene along the genome is likely to be on the same strand, whether it's more likely to be on the same strand or opposite strand. I just wanted to I have one slide of intron size distribution, and this, I think Chris actually showed something similar this morning, but it does make the point that in C. elegans you have this very sharp peak, and actually the mode is at 47 base pairs, which is the most frequent intron size in C. elegans. So there does seem to be significant size constraints. It's not actually clear to me that this probably does, as Chris was speculating, represent selection for particular sizes, but it also could be, it could reflect the fact, I mean, it could be basically reflect neutral evolution. We know deletion mutations occur more frequently in evolution than insertion mutations. So any particular stretch of DNA tends to get shorter over evolutionary time, unless something inserts into it, like a transposable element. And so if you have sort of short introns, it probably is just the mutation pressures tend to push them towards the minimum possible size. And so it's not necessarily the case that this is really an optimal size for splicing. It may just be that it's a minimum feasible size, and that the mutation pressures are pushing things in that direction.
Can't be too small just for mechanical reasons.
Yeah, probably. Right. It's probably some kind of stereochemical.
This is RNA. You can make mutations. It has to do with the size of the machine.
Right. Well, I truncated this at 150, and could not get PowerPoint to delete that part of the graph. But it's C. elegans does have much larger introns, up to 10 or 15 kb. They're not nearly as big as what you see in the human, either in terms of the maximum size that's observed or the average size. But you can, you do get, there is quite a long tail that goes out to tens of kb.
All the ones that humans say must be able to figure
out. Right.
And are there also repetitive elements and stuff that make them?
Yes. Yeah. Right. But this is truncated 150. I truncated it. It's not. Well, no, not necessarily, because they could be ones into which repetitive transposable elements have inserted.
It's funny because there are base bias in the intron, the model of the base in the intron. If you get them, it's very well in the
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Actually, it does, if you look at the splice sites, the splice sites themselves, this, I think this was observed by Chris Fields back in the early 90s. For larger introns, the splice site scores are higher. And that makes sense because the bigger the intron is, the harder it is, presumably, for the splicing machinery to do it accurately, so it does need more information. On the other hand, the amount of additional information it gets, at least just right at the splice site, is not enough to account for it. But it may well also be other signals, either in the exons or introns, like Chris was talking about, that are, and you may well need more of those in larger introns than in others. Do you know, Chris, have you looked at sort of frequency of signals as a function of intron size?
Well, we also look at the frequency of the intron size, and we
right, but I meant specifically looking for these enhancer elements, for example.
We have mostly in humans, and the elements that we know are something rich, and they're therefore preferentially in short and time.
Right, but we have not looked systematically at that at C. elegans. C. elegans actually might well be better because it's a more homogeneous genome. It doesn't have this isochore variation in GC content that the human genome has that complicates the picture. Sorry? Yeah, I think this goes... I think it's about 35, or something like that. So it can deal with something shorter than. Yeah, as far as I know, there were none in this set of 8,192. Any time is fine with me. Let me just give one more slide, which is on exon number distribution, which is interesting. So this was, I think, in a set of 800 or so genes that we got out of GenBank. But it makes the point that it points up a deficiency in our model because we have this Markov type model for sites. There's no way of incorporating into that model unless you were to make longer length dependencies. Any information about the exon number distribution. In fact, the model itself predicts a geometric distribution for the number of exons in a gene, and this just makes the point that distribution does not look geometric, that there are relatively few genes that have just a single exon. You actually, I think the next slide I've blown, the most frequent number of exons is 8, and I really don't know what this pattern is all about, or whether it's statistically significant. But you clearly have something with a mode at a number of exons between 5 and 10, and then it does tail off. But I'll actually come back to that later because I think that could indicate. Something about the set of genes that is in GenBank, and biases that have gone into discovering those genes. All right, so we can stop here if people want. Okay, so the next aspect of the model is probabilities of the sequences. And so there are really several types of sequences we're interested in modeling. The sites, splice sites, translation start and stop sites, but also the coding sequence and the intronic sequence and the intergenic sequence. And so we'd like to have probability models for each of those types of sequence. And this actually, I think, is what we do here is a bit, is maybe a little different from what's typically done in other programs. It's actually, I think, inspired by an observation of Chris Burge's relating to splice sites, but we we use the same sort of idea also to model a coding sequence and background sequence, and which I think is not done in other programs, and that turns out to be useful. So the idea, again, is that so here now we're talking about sequence of nucleotides rather than a sequence of sites. The same general fact is true that any probability distribution on a set of sequences can be expressed in terms of conditional probabilities in this way. And now we do want to allow a simple Markov model is not adequate, so we need something, we need to be able to take into account more distant dependencies. But we want to do this in a way that's somewhat more flexible than a sort of a traditional Markov model. So this is the actually the example that Burge and Carlin had pointed out. This is C. elegans data, but the same fact holds. And what I'm showing here is a frequency matrix, a count matrix, and a frequency matrix for nucleotide occurrences at various positions around 5' splice sites. So this is in the set of 8,192 C. elegans sites. So you have an invariant G, an almost invariant T, but you sometimes have GC instead of GT. And you've got other positions that are conserved to varying degrees, but all of them have much more variability than the dinucleotide at the start of the intron does. So this is a plot of the frequencies of the different nucleotides at position. So again, here's the G and the T. This is in the intron, and as you can see, it's generally T rich, although it's AT rich, and there regions. This is actually this corresponds, in fact, to the branch site upstream of the 3' splice site, so you get an enrichment for A nucleotides there. But it's actually interesting. You see a little bit of periodicity in the coding sequence that has to do with the fact that the different intron phases don't occur with the same frequency. If the intron, there's a tendency in essentially all eukaryotes for introns to be preferentially inserted in the so-called phase zero location, which means between the last base of one codon and the first base of the next codon. And that's as a result of that excess of phase zero exons or phase zero introns. These a majority of these sequences are actually in frame with respect to each other, and so you see a little bit of threefold periodicity that reflects coding sequence usage. But the observation that that Chris made was that that there are dependencies within the site, and in particular, if you look at the minus one position, that is the last base of the exon. There's a preference, overall there's a preference for G there. 60% of the time G is used in that position. And so it's interesting to divide up the sequences according to the ones that do have that G and those which do not have the G. And what you see is that it has a significant effect on the frequencies of nucleotides at other positions. So in particular, here fixing the G, the more dramatic tendency is if you don't have a G at that minus one position, then you've got much stronger conservation at these downstream positions, which are positions 4, 4, 5, and 6 into the intron. The same nucleotides are still preferred there when you do have a G, but not, the frequency is lower. So the explanation of that was that that they offered was that splicing involves a pairing of a small RNA with the transcript, the RNA transcript at the 5' splice site. That small RNA, small nuclear RNA, is complementary to the 5' splice site consensus sequence. And if you have a mismatch at one position, then particularly at this minus one position, that tends to destabilize the pairing and makes it more important for the other positions then to be correctly paired if splicing is to be carried out efficiently. So that seems to account for the dependencies between different positions. So there is that sequence is the small RNA sequence is complementary to the consensus sequence at the splice site. In terms of a detailed, what you'd really like to have is a detailed understanding of the energetics of the interaction and what happens if you change one nucleotide. And I'm not sure that's been done.
I'm thinking that is that this model is still sort of the idea that the energy is additive. It's just that there's sort of a threshold behind what you go down. Mm-hmm. If you have a stabilized interaction here, you have to have contact and energy elsewhere. It seems that that process is very much what you're doing when you're actually using these methods. Is that what you do is you allocate energies and you see does it fall above or below cutoff. So it seems that the idea of the fact that you have, if this one is not right and you need more correctness in order to identify, is already included in your analysis rather than it being appropriate to include correlation explicitly in it.
Well, except that, it's not included, that's true. I think what you say is true in the sense that you do have, there are pressures presumably to maintain a particular or scores in a certain range. What you would like to have is a probability model that tells you the probability of particular sequences being observed in splice sites versus probability of observing them in non-splice sites. And if you want to do that, to develop an explicit probability model, I think you need to bring in the dependencies. But it is sort of, what you're saying is that probably is the underlying explanation for why the dependency exists, but you want to bring that into the model to the extent that you can actually have a probability associated to each particular sequence. And
another comment about that. So we think that actually, well, knowing that time is lasting,
four base pairs in a row, and you have two base pairs here. So, therefore, you tend to, if you don't have a base pair here, then you want to have a cluster of base pairs here.
I don't know. I haven't seen one. But. Yeah. Well, so it depends on the width, the size of the window you're looking at, and if you're looking at a big enough window, then 8,192 examples is not going to be big enough to sample the entire space. Well, so for splice sites, we typically use five bases. I think it's five bases into the exon and 20 into the intron, so it's 25. So that's already big enough that you're not sampling the whole thing. So anyway, the way we go about estimating these conditional probabilities is, I think it's a fairly obvious idea, but you line up the sequences. And we apply this, so for sites, you do that in the obvious way, just positioning all your sequences at the location of the site. But we want to model, use the same idea to model background and coding sequence. And for those, there are generally multiple ways of lining them up. Coding sequence, for example, you would take the same coding sequence and offset it by multiples of three nucleotides and consider all those alignments and then estimate the conditional probabilities including all those offsets. But then the idea for finding significant dependencies is you focus on a particular position I, and we basically want to develop conditional probabilities of observing a particular nucleotide at position I conditional on the nucleotides that precede it. But we don't want to make it conditional on all nucleotides that precede it, just the ones that are important in some sense. So I think the idea is fairly straightforward. You count the occurrences of the nucleotides at the ith position. That gives you sort of the baseline frequencies. The overall marginal log probability for the set of sequences in your training set is given by this formula. It's just the sum over the different nucleotides n of the number of times C sub n occurs times the log of the frequency. Yeah. This could be sites, or it could be coding sequences that are lined up, with each coding sequence actually being represented multiple times at multiple of three offset, or it could be background sequence. Yeah. It's probably clearest if you think of sites initially. For each, we want to look at different possible positions upstream of I and see which of those have the most predictive power to which of those affect the probability the most, in the sense that if we condition the probability on the nucleotide that occurs at the J-th prediction, what gives us the biggest improvement in the overall log probability? And so we do that in a very simple-minded way. We just scan all the upstream positions and consider each nucleotide at each position. When you fix a nucleotide at a position, that gives you a partition of your set of site sequences into those that do and do not have that nucleotide at that position. Then you, for each of those subsets, you count the number of occurrences of each nucleotide at the ith position, and you'll get different sets of counts for the two subsets, and you get corresponding log probabilities. You always get an increase in the overall log probability by conditioning on the nucleotide at the jth position. We use the minimum description length principle to decide when that's enough of an improvement in the log probability that we want to incorporate that into the model. If you don't do something like that, then you get a serious overfitting problem, you could keep improving the probabilities, refining your model till you got to the point where basically it attached, if you have n sequences in your training set, the model would attach a probability of 1 over n to each sequence in your training set and 0 to every other sequence. So you would totally fit your model to the training set, and that would clearly be useless for prediction. So the minimum description length principle is just a way of avoiding that overfitting, and it basically says that you only accept a partition if the cost in terms of the number of bits you need to specify the additional parameters does not outweigh the gain in the log probability itself. So you basically have to sum the cost and the log probability and only accept the partition if you're getting an overall improvement. And that's a pretty standard, I wouldn't say it's standard, but it's a well-known and widely utilized method in statistics for avoiding overfitting to a data set. And so we do, we basically iterate that process. We found the best position, the best nucleotide at that position in terms of the improvement, and then that gives us a split of the training set into two subsets, and then we repeat on each subset and iterate that and until you get to the point where you're no longer getting a significant improvement in the sum of the log probability and the cost to specify the parameters. So that's is that something like what you do, Chris, with splice sites? That was certainly the inspiration. Your observation was certainly the inspiration for thinking about this. But it turns out to be useful in modeling coding sequence and background sequence as well, and it's a way of going beyond a fixed order Markov chain kind of model that allows you to take to capture more distant dependencies without overfitting your data. So at any rate, the idea. So once you've found these dependencies, when you want to compute a probability for a new sequence, a test sequence, you do it by considering each position in turn in the sequence, looking up you basically look up the appropriate leaf in this tree of dependencies, and that gives you predicted frequency for each nucleotide at the position you're looking at, and then that that frequency is the conditional probability of observing the frequency that you have, and you just take a product of that over positions. So this does a good job of capturing the site information, but also for what's interesting for me, and what I don't fully understand yet, is that it captures actually fairly distant dependencies in coding sequence as well. And I think, although I haven't totally sorted this out, that it's actually capturing aspects of protein structure constraints. So things like amphipathic helices, which give you a certain a periodicity in the amino acid pattern, and possibly other aspects of protein structure are being captured by the model. We find significant dependencies that are actually up to 21 nucleotides away, and so they're fairly distant, but they're statistically significant. And also, it seems to be a good way of capturing dependencies in background sequence. So basically, we see we get not only dinucleotide, trinucleotide dependencies, but also it's a good way of capturing the excess frequency of mononucleotide runs, which is one of the more striking features of non-coding sequence when you look at its statistical properties, is that runs of A's or runs of C's, G's or T's, tend to occur more frequently than you would expect. And this does manage to capture that. So anyway, I think I'll need to speed up on some of the details, but remember, what we were interested in maximizing was the joint probability of the parse and the sequence, and basically we used a few tricks to simplify the problem of finding the maximum likelihood parse, and I won't go through all the details there, but You can basically break it up into a sum over coding exons, and if you subtract off the probability of the sequence under the background model, that basically cancels the terms from the intronic sequence and the intergenic sequence, and leaves you with a sum over exons, So you can think of the entire problem of calculating the probability as a maximizing probability as a problem of maximizing maximizing the choice of exons, and that's how we do it. You can use dynamic programming to find the maximum likelihood parse as a set of exons, and so that can be done reasonably fast. We'll go through the details there. We also model the transplice leader, location of the transplice leader site, there's kind of an ad hoc correction to deal with pairs of low scoring sequences, but let me just get to the actual tests of how well the model does. So we took as a training set, we took this set of 8,192 introns from the Sanger Center. These were known introns that were derived from EST and cDNA alignments, and we used those to compute an intron size distribution and the splice site models. We also took a set of about 100 coding sequences. We initially did not have any translation start or stop site information or exon size distribution, intergene or intergene spacing information, and tried to basically bootstrap our way to to get that information from the initial prediction. So the idea was, and this has been an idea that's been used before, we generated initial predictions using the model we have and very simple models for the sites that we did not have data for, the translation start and stop sites. Generated those initial predictions and then used the predictions themselves to re-estimate the parameters for a second prediction pass. So this is actually an interesting question, interesting problem as to how to make this process work. There are a number of issues involved because some parameters are unstable when you try to make bootstrap estimates, in the sense that the noise in your predictions, and inevitably you will have noise, tends to push you away from the true parameter values. As a result, the estimates of those parameters actually become worse and worse as you iterate. But for other parameters, you get substantial improvement. In general, we found that the prediction accuracy does improve substantially with a couple of additional passes using the predictions from earlier passes. And that's probably mainly, I think, it gives you get very important information on exon size distribution, which we did not have initially, and also for the coding sequence models. Yeah. Yeah, so the sequence model is the conditional probabilities of the sequence given the parse. The probability of a particular sequence observing at a splice site, for example, or the probability of a particular coding sequence, a sequence being observed as the coding sequence in an exon. So it's a separate part of the problem. Am I misunderstanding your question, or? I did have a slide that mentioned the different components that go into the conditional probability of a site given the preceding site. The type probabilities are mostly they're one or zero, because for example, if you have a three prime splice site, they're not all one or zero. If you have a five prime splice site, then that has to be followed by a three prime splice site. If you have a three prime splice site, that has to be followed either by another five prime splice site or by a translation stop site. So you do have probabilities that enter there that basically are determined by the average number of exons in a gene. Right.
You can maximize your probabilities that you define in this minimum description
Well, the minimum description length, that comes in the sequence models, not...
I just use this word to indicate the entire sequence model. It refers to this model on the path, defined by sort of dynamic programming of search algorithms, here at the optimum path to the other.
So anyway, to give the prediction, the results, so we had, we started from a set of 134 genes in chromosome 1 that were identified by aligning cDNAs from GenBank to the chromosome 1 sequence. I should say one slight caveat. What we need to do before we get this fully written up is to eliminate. There is a little bit of overlap with the training set, and we have not eliminated that yet. I'm 99% confident that will make no difference in the final results, both because the overlap is small, and the also because of the fact what we do to avoid overfitting. But still, that needs to be done. Some of the cDNAs turned out to be apparently incorrect, or either the genomic sequence or the cDNA is wrong because they're inconsistent with each other. We then generated predictions using the model I just described for the entire chromosome. That was about a half-hour computer run, including the training, and actually the majority of it was the training. Then there were, when we eliminated, there were 113 distinct genes represented after eliminating the ones that were inconsistent and grouping together the ones that were different alternatively spliced forms for the same gene. And what we, so the results are the following. About 71% of the genes were predicted exactly, meaning that every exon, every site was correct. At the exon level, about 95% of the exons were predicted exactly. Another almost 4% were partially predicted, and only 1.5% were missed entirely. We didn't miss any genes entirely. There was one gene that was only covered, about 50% covered by the prediction, but the others were all substantially better than that. And then at the per base level, 99.4% of the bases were predicted correctly in the sense that the base was included in a predicted exon, and the reading frame across that exon was correct. So the caveat to all this is we don't know what, there's presumably some false positive rate, and we have no idea what it is. This is chromosome 1.
Let's see how we...
Sorry? Well, there are 113 genes are known in chromosome 1. It has there are many more genes than the ones in our test set. The total number of genes we predict on the chromosome was is between 3,000 and 4,000. The test set, the known genes for which there are full-length cDNAs available in GenBank is 113. That's a caveat, but that we don't know how many false positives there may be among the predictions. And one thing we hope to do is to start systematically going through predictions and trying to verify them in possibly in a way similar to what Chris talked about. The types of errors, I won't go through all these, but the errors that are made are, they don't, they fall into a number of different categories. So you have 1 or 2% error rates in each of a large number of different categories. So I think it's not, that suggests to me that it's not going to be possible to get a big improvement in performance by one change, a simple change in the program. I think it'll require a combination of several types of changes, several improvements. And we have, there are a number of improvements that we have in mind. Actually, I list them on a later slide. But I wanted to point out differences between that we see between the sort of the global characteristics of our predictions and known genes. So here's, in fact, let me go to the next slide. Here I've plotted for the known genes in C. elegans and our predicted genes on chromosome 1, what the distribution of the number of exons looks like. And as you can see, it's pretty different. That the known genes tend to have more exons than the predicted ones do. The mode actually with the predicted genes is at 2. You have relatively more genes with a single exon in the predicted genes than you do with the in the known genes, and so it's a pretty different looking distribution. And the question is, why do they look so different? It's possible that some of it is due to noise in the predictions. That is, we're making false positive predictions at some rate, and those may be biased towards simpler gene structures. I'm sure there's some of that, but the we also think that part of the bias, or part of the difference, is due to the fact that known genes are not representative of the genome. It's also true that the coding sequence, the average length of the coding sequences in these known genes is quite high. It's 1,800 base pairs. That's actually higher than you see with sets of human genes or Drosophila genes. And I think it points to a significant bias in the C. elegans genes that are in the database, which is that they were a large number of them were isolated by screening for mutants. So geneticists applied mutagens to worms, looked for mutants having a particular phenotype of interest, and then clone the gene. When you do that, there's an obvious bias towards getting a large gene, because the larger genes are larger targets for mutation. So that, I think, is almost certainly distorting the set of known genes, that they're bigger, both in terms of their entire coding length, but also in terms of the number of exons than the average gene is. Well, so the average size for the predicted is it's less than 1,400. So it's a reasonably big discrepancy, almost 30% discrepancy. And certainly, not all the known genes were identified by mutation screens, and there are short genes among the known ones as well. But the mutation screens do seem to have significantly distorted the picture. I think we do have some improvements to make in the model. We're actually not using a true background model yet. The background model we're using is estimated from total genomic DNA, and not strictly from intergenic and intronic DNA, which is what it should be estimated from. We're using a constant penalty for the intergene size distribution, which basically corresponds to a uniform distribution. That's really not not correct. And also the model we're using for transplice leaders could be improved. There's some other issues. I won't go through all these, but we would like. There are a number of things that I think should be put into gene prediction programs to bring them closer to the real biological situation. One is that I think the model itself really should include pseudogenes, those should be included as among the biological features with coding sequence that you probabilistically model in order to